Welcome to the Screw the Clout. I'm your host, Steve Stanulis. Each week, we're going to have amazing guests share their stories of saying, screw it. Tune in each week. This is Screw the Clout. Welcome to another episode of Screw the Clout. We have another amazing guest. Today on our show, we have Dr. Maria Mayer, who has a great story. I don't want to say unusual story, but again, I'm excited to go down how this came to be. So Dr. Maria, how are we doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. And I would probably say it's unusual.
Well, I get it. It kind of is. And that's what attracted me. And that's what we always look for. Is this something you always wanted to do as far as being a filmmaker? Do you have say on each particular episode? Or is it just something that they tell you when you go?
No, so I'm not scripted. I mean, I think part of what makes me unique on TV is that I get to play me, right? And the reason that I get put on these shows is because I come with a long history of not just television experience, but expertise as a primatologist, you know, working with different animals all over the world, particularly primates. So I don't get a script, which I love because I don't generally like to be told what to do.
Sure.
But I get to speak from the heart and from experience. And I think that's what's really resonated with people and what's made me sort of unique in the world of science communication is that I'm not just sort of a Muppet for what somebody else wants to have out there.
And that's what I find pretty amazing. So growing up, were you into primates or was it just an animal thing in general? And it kind of focus towards that, or how'd that come to pass?
So growing up, I grew up in a big city in Miami, Florida. And in particular, I grew up in an area called Little Havana. My parents are Cuban immigrants. My mom is really overprotective, if you know anything about Cuban mothers. And so when I asked if I could join the Girl Scouts, she was like, no way, that's too dangerous. So I had no sort of real thoughts about going off into the wild and studying animals, but I was obsessed with animals as a kid. And my house was basically a zoo because I would bring in stray dogs and cats and birds. And I mean, I had a little pet chicken and fish, and I mean, you name it, creepy crawlies. I would spend a lot of time up in a mango tree, you know, looking at lizards and how they moved. So I did have this obsession, but I actually went to school to become a lawyer. I was a pre-law student. And
okay.
Wow. I had to take a science class that then led me into anthropology. That's when I realized, okay, that is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
That within itself is, you know, a wild transition. So you're in law school and at some point you go to anthropology. Do you have any, not, I don't want to say brushback, but what's your family saying when you say, hey, you know, I mean, I know I'm in law school, but you know what? My calling is anthropology. So how did that go over with family?
So yeah, no, it's funny because at the time I was also a cheerleader for the Miami Dolphins. So not exactly what you would imagine, you know.
Which again, I was going to bring up later, but yes.
You know, so yeah. So my friends were like, why in the world would you want to go into the jungles where you have no electricity and hair dryers and, you know, all of the comforts? My mom thought I was going to die. I had never left the country. I had never even been camping. She was a nurse, so she only saw like all the horrible potential things that could happen out there. But in her own Cuban mother way, she supported me because she ironed my field pants before I went off into the field. Oh,
that's awesome. That's yeah. Awesome. So being a animate Jets fan, that's been numerous times to, you know, Miami to watch the games. The most interesting thing I found about that stadium was the cheerleaders.
Thank you.
How did that whole thing come up now? Are you in law school at that time and this opportunity comes up, or is it something just that you're doing to make money, you know, some side money? How does that happen?
Yeah, you don't really make money doing that. But
no, I know. I think it's like $100 a game or something, right?
Back when I was doing it, it was like $50 a game. So that was definitely not the motivating factor. So I was still an undergraduate in pre-law at the University of Miami, and I had always been very athletic growing up. Like I loved playing basketball and softball and all the things. I had never actually been a cheerleader, which is what's sort of funny. because the only reason that I went for it, not because I had some dream of becoming a cheerleader, but because I was such a huge football fan and basically really couldn't afford the tickets. And I thought, well, what better beat, right, than on the sidelines cheering on a team that I grew up with and loving. And that's how it all got started.
So never being a cheerleader or going, you know, cheering in high school or college, when you go for your auditions, is it like, how's that work?
Terrifying. I didn't make my, you know, cheerleading squad in high school. So I already was traumatized right. as it was. And then funny enough, there were a couple girls from my high school who were cheerleaders also trying out. And I was like, oh yeah, like this is never going to happen. But that's where my sort of determination and resilience really kicked in, because I just honestly, I worked harder than anyone. I would be off to the corner, just going over the routines over and over and over. And they were really comfortable because it was second nature to them. Right. And they'd be sitting and, you know, chatting and laughing it up. And I was like, nope. And I just kept working and working. And well, I suppose it paid off. I mean, there was a little part of me that was like, you didn't let me on the high school team. And yeah, and I made the Dolphins. So
awesome. So how many years did that go?
4 years. I did it
oh,
all.
Wow.
The time. I was an undergrad. Yeah.
So you were in it. So I mean,
that,
yeah, it was, I thought it was one or two. I didn't realize it was four. So, I mean, that's amazing. So again, kudos, because, you know, it was random and you went for it. And again, that's what I love about this podcast. That's what we tell people all the time. If you want something, just go for it. You know, worst case, you try it and it doesn't happen. So one more question on the cheerleading, and then we'll move on, is so what is that first experience? You know, the first game of the season, your first time cheerleading, what is that like for you?
Oh my God. I will really never forget running through that tunnel and going onto the field and just seeing the, you know, tens of thousands of people in the stands. But what I really like to this day stays with me, because it never got old. It was every game when they played the national anthem and you're looking at everyone and you're standing there and you're representing, you know, this team. Anyway, it was just such a powerful, beautiful, also extremely terrifying, nerve-wracking feeling, but really sort of amazing.
That's amazing. That's again, you know, with all your achievements, I guarantee you that's something you'll never forget. I mean, what is your first trip to somewhere like Africa or Congo? What is that like? So again, you're from Miami. You've never experienced anything like that, right? Are you saying, what am I getting myself into? Are you excited? You know, what is that vibe like?
So I'm super excited, very green-eyed, you know, naive, setting off on this unbelievable adventure. My first expedition was to the Amazon. And of course, I didn't keep it simple. I went to the most remote and unexplored part of the Amazon. So I was deep in it, you know, green abyss, impenetrable forest, hacking my way with a machete to get through it. I lived out of a dugout canoe for months. And there were moments where I had just quit being a cheerleader, right, to go do
right.
this. There were moments that, yeah, I was homesick. And I thought back to those days where, oh boy, I could be with the girls right now, you know, just like at the football field.
Watching Dan Marino.
Watching Dan Marino. But I never for a moment have regretted that decision. It was a very steep learning curve. But I looked around me and I saw like these unbelievable waterfalls and on these rivers, and then looking at the monkeys overhead. And I was like, yeah, this is where I want to be.
Wow. And again, I'm just going to ask you a question. How do you deal with the fucking bugs and the mosquitoes?
Oh my God.
And, you know, how do you deal with that? Because like I said, I go in my yard sometimes at night and I get like two flies. I'm like, I'm going inside. So yeah, how does that
it's
work?
So annoying. I've had, I've been covered in bug bites, like head to toes, and it's funny because I'm a conservationist, so obviously like I protect animals, I don't want to harm any animals, but mosquitoes are off that I will kill any mosquito that comes near me. It's just annoying. There's these little sweat bees in Congo, for example, that they literally are like attracted to your sweat, so they get into your ears, through your eyes, like they're kind of everywhere. And they, at one point I was completely covered in them, and I just they were driving me nuts. But here's what happens. Then I had gorillas that had come closer and I was watching them, and I forget all about the bugs. Like the bugs aren't even there. I'm so focused. I'm so excited to see what I'm seeing in front of me. That was like, that's it. Then you forget the bugs, but they're annoying.
That's great. No, no doubt. And, you know, so you start doing this on a regular basis. And then you become like the first female, right? Correspondent for National Geographic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty amazing itself. I mean,
it's pretty exciting.
How does that whole thing materialize? I mean, National Geographic, if you know, you're into what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's like the Sports Illustrated of, you know, what have you. So how did that come to pass? And you know, how far into your career now doing this before this happens?
So I was in grad school working on my PhD, and National Geographic came to Madagascar where I was doing my research, and they were actually they were filming someone else and they were filming other animals. And then the producer started asking me questions about my research and what I was doing, and became super interested in it. And the next thing I knew, I had a film crew at my field site coming to film what I'm doing, because this was the first time these animals had ever been studied, and actually the first time that they had even been photographed. So it was sort of a really cool story, but I thought that was going to be it. You know, like we did this documentary and then I would never hear from them again. And the next thing I know, they were offering me a position to not just talk about like my work, but the work of so many other people all over the world doing research on some of the most incredible animals. And I mean, that was like, it was a dream I never even knew I had, but I knew that I had to take it, because there aren't, even to this day, there aren't a lot of women at the televisual forefront when it comes to exploration and adventure. And, you know, it's usually like, you know, white, khaki clad men, you know, but to see a woman like waist deep in swamp, you know, really going for it, I thought this is really cool for, you know, for young girls and young women to say, okay, yeah, we can do this. Not to mention my past as a cheerleader, like what a great way to also send the message of you don't need to be pigeonholed or be, you know, stay in a box, right? Like you could, like you could do all sorts of different things. And so that was important to me.
That's amazing. And then what don't most people know with when they're dealing with primates, and you know, what is something that you would only be able to see that people don't realize? And what is the craziest or the scariest thing that ever happened when you were there dealing with them?
So yeah, super question. I think that the adrenaline, like, so for example, being charged by a 450-pound silverback gorilla, the adrenaline that happens in that moment, like it never goes away, no matter how many times you're charged. Like the power of these animals is just kind of unbelievable. But I think the most beautiful thing that I've learned in watching primates is just how sort of caring they are, what great moms they are, how, you know, if an old silverback is kind of in his last days, all the females will sort of slow down and wait for him, and they kind of come together as a family. And I think it's a really beautiful thing to watch that most people don't really, you know about, like these really strong family bonds is what I love. And that primates have very individual personalities. Like some are super shy, some are really funny. I mean, some are outright, you know, bitches or mean. Like, I mean, they just have like really complex personalities, like people. Yeah.
Right. They're like, what, one or two chromosomes away from humans? You still didn't tell me what happened when the 450-pound silverback was shaking. How did that stop?
Well, I mean, clearly I survived. Well, they just... Generally, they're just bluffing and they're letting you know, like, this is my territory, you know, and they just give you these reminders. But the scariest, let's say, animal encounter was being actually chased by a forest elephant. They're a lot faster than people think, even though they're really big. But but my scariest always are not animals, or it's humans, right? I've worked in Congo. I've worked in areas like where there's a lot of political upheaval
Right.
and violence. And so I survived a plane crash in Congo. That might be top of the list.
I was going to say, if you survived a silverback 450-pound gorilla coming at you, how the hell do you survive a plane crash? Because that's, again, not something most people could say, or, you know, if they were in a plane crash, or not being able to say anything. So how does that happen?
So, well, I was actually, funny enough, I was just finished with this one gorilla study that I was doing, and me and a film producer and a cameraman were heading home, right? Heading out of the field. And we got on this flight, and I was sitting there writing in my journal, and I start looking out the window, and all of a sudden I notice that the plane is starting to descend a lot earlier. Like, we still had 2 more hours on this flight.
Right.
And it's a big commercial plane. I mean, this isn't like some little Cessna. And anyway, then it starts to go up again. So I thought, okay, maybe they were avoiding turbulence. But then it starts to do it again, and this time at a much more fierce velocity. And I start looking around me, and I see that the stewardesses are in crash mode position, you know, with their knees up and hold it. And
right.
And like, they still haven't made an announcement, like, no. But what's very now in hindsight funny about this situation is that nearly every passenger on this flight was actually a nun. And as I looked
Oh, wow.
around, and like, as I looked around the flight, they were all praying. Like, every single one of them was praying. And I still to this day credit those nuns for
Absolutely.
like, you know, saving us in this situation. But we did crash land. Plane is probably still sitting there in the middle of Congo somewhere. But we don't really know what happened. There were stories about whether the gas was siphoned. I mean, there were all sorts of stories, but it's because it happened where it happened, it's really difficult to really get a real
Right.
answer.
Real answer. Did you get injured, and was there any fatalities?
There weren't any fatalities,
Oh,
and
thank God.
other than, you know, a lot of mental trauma and some PTSD after that, I wasn't physically injured. But the aftermath of that was also sort of humorous, in that eventually they started sending trucks to you know, rescue people, in essence, right? Get us out of there. And people were just like jumping on the back of these pickup trucks as they started rolling in. And so eventually I jumped on the back of a pickup truck. And for the night, like, there's not a lot of options of where you stay there, right? It's not like there's a Hilton on
There's
every
no Ritz-Carlton.
No. And so I ended up spending the night at a brothel.
That's so fun.
And remember, I'll never forget thinking, I had never been so happy to smell like this cheap Chanel number 5, because it meant I was
That's
alive,
great.
but I was in a
That's great.
brothel now. So
That's
I
great.
went from gorillas to a plane crash with nuns to a brothel. I mean, it was just the most
Yeah,
surreal
that's a movie.
experience.
That is a movie right
There
there.
you go. Maybe you could like produce
Maybe
this.
that was my next idea, maybe, right? So I guess the moral of the story is, here, next time I go on a
I'm
plane,
none.
at least hopefully there's at least one nun
One.
on the plane. At least one. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So that's another amazing, again, very, such an interesting life. I just have, and again, this is more for my father-in-law, because because he always fights me on this. And I try to explain to him as a filmmaker that, you know, it's not as real as you think.
Right.
What is your take on Naked and Afraid?
Oh my gosh. That's also a funny story. So I was approached the very first season, like before it ever launched, about appearing on it. And I remember I was on vacation with my family at like a beach vacation. And I took a Zoom call with a production company, literally in a bikini, because I was just like, I'm on vacation, and they wanted to talk to me kind of urgently. And I remember saying to the producer, you really don't want me for this show, because I don't really have a lot of issue with nudity, right? I'm a mom, like, I don't really care, and I'm not going to be afraid. So I'm just not going to be the right person for this show. So I don't know. They came back a couple more times, and I think they finally got the message that I wasn't going to do it. I don't know much of how they you know, really what goes on out there.
Right.
You know, it's difficult to say, but it's an entertaining show for sure.
No, it's definitely, it's funny. I just tell them, like, listen, if they're eating again, there's a cast. There's the two, obviously the two subjects, right? That are doing this, but obviously you have a producer, directors, you have crew, you know, that at nighttime are going to go back. You know, you have crafty. So you're
right.
telling me, you know, at no point they don't have access to, you know, any, you know, anything if they're really, you know. So again, he really believes, like, no, that's it. They're just out there in the there, and that's it. And they, you know, so that's always a big obvious. So, I mean, if there's anybody to ask to use as a reference, that's why I figured let me ask, because, you know, I was just, that's an ongoing Sunday dinner argument we always have, because they go crazy for that show. So so moving forward, you get approached by Mark Burnett, right? Who's a, you know, powerhouse.
Sure.
How does he find you? What is that dialogue like? And was it something he pitched to you, or how does that go down?
Yeah, so Mark Burnett approached me because he was looking for four modern day explorers who were basically the real deal, because we would need to be out there for a couple months surviving on our own with absolutely no interaction with the crew, for example. Like, no one was allowed to talk to us even as we were being mic'd. Like, no one could break that fourth wall. So he needed people who actually knew what they were doing out there. And the premise of the show was for these four modern day explorers to follow in the footsteps of Henry Morton Stanley's famous search for Dr. Livingston. And so my initial gut reaction was that I didn't really want to do like a reality show, because I didn't know who was, they would tell me who else was going to be on the show, or basically really anything else other than that I would be there as the wildlife expert, you know, making sure people didn't, for example, set up tents, you know, on a hippo path, and could identify snakes and all of these other things, right? And who also had a background as a survivalist, and who could bear the months of just, we had to source our own food. There was no, in this case, I can tell you, there was no access to crafties or anything else.
Right.
We were filmed 24/7. It was a very big brother in the field situation. And I just wasn't sure until he said that as part of the show, we wouldn't be given any modern day equipment. It would be in the same way that Henry Morton Stanley went off on his search. So a compass, a sextant, you know, no tents. It was really pretty hardcore. And so that is the part that actually really excited me, and the reason that I signed on, because I had read all these amazing journals of these people, and I wanted to experience it in the same way that they had. That was one of the toughest expeditions that I'd ever been on. And then, of course, what you I should have guessed, because it is at the end of the day a reality show, right? Is that they cast four very type A personalities. All of us had a lot of experience in the field, and we had all led our own expedition. So imagine putting the four of us together to sort of work it out on this
right,
expedition.
Right. Well, that's great. Right? That's great. Yeah.
So there was a lot of in-house fighting and differences in opinions on how to do things and how to get somewhere and how to get the food, make the food,
right,
filter the water. I mean, it was just like insanity that way.
That's amazing. And again, yeah, I can do some due diligence. They actually gave you the nickname, right? The female Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I don't know when that started,
that's pretty cool. I mean,
pretty cool. Yeah, the New York Times was like, you know, the female Indiana Jones, and then it just like it stuck, and I'm like, yeah, I'll take that.
I'll use that. You know, I'll take that. I'll use that everywhere. I mean, that's gold. You know,
exactly.
So now, what we're doing now today is you're doing now Expedition Bigfoot.
Correct.
So, and that is on what network?
It's on Discovery Channel and Discovery Plus.
Discovery Channel. Discovery. Now, has any seasons aired yet, or they're about to?
Yeah, we actually just finished filming season 5.
Okay, awesome.
So
again,
season 5 will be airing very soon.
So again, what is different with your show? Because again, with Bigfoot, because a lot of these shows, Bigfoot's obviously probably the biggest. I don't want to say mythical or, I don't think he's mythical. I actually think he exists, to be quite honest,
do
if you
you?
Can ask me. I do, because, I mean, there's a lot of, back in the day, nobody had, if you happen to see something, in the 70s, 80s, everybody's got cameras now. So there's a lot of footage, whether it's tapered with or not, or tampered, I should say. But I think so. I mean, yes, it's weird because with all our technology, drones, this, that nobody actually ever caught one or actually, but I almost hope they don't, because what would happen if they did? I mean, that poor thing would be.
there'd have to be a whole lot of measures in place.
Yeah. What would you say your show angle is as opposed to other shows?
Sure. So what I love about our show is that it's very grounded in science, which is not really the case in a lot of the other shows. Like, there's definitely people on our show that truly, truly believe in Bigfoot or have had experiences, with Bigfoot. And I'm on the show basically to just ground it in science. So I know that there are tens of thousands of like witnesses that come forward with their stories, and I'm super open to hearing all of those. And I think that they're super brave in coming out because there's a stigma that's attached, right? But for me, it's all about the physical evidence. And so that's what I'm there to do and collect and try to find. And so that was another show that, again, when I was approached, I was like, that's not what I do. I don't know anything about Bigfoot, and no idea.
Right.
Like, I mean, I've heard of the myth, the legend, but I don't know anything about it. And they said, no, that's why we want you, because we want you to take your field experience in the wild with primates and apply it here, like a real scientific investigation. And so, anyway, I gave it a shot, right? I said, well, let's see how this, let's see what this is all about. And I've actually come to really love the time in the field, and honestly have experienced some pretty surreal stuff and have found some, I wouldn't necessarily say evidence, but some really cool findings that, kind of make your eyebrow raise and keeps me up at night. So there's some very cool stuff out there, and it's something that I'm really enjoying.
Gun to your head, do you believe there's a Bigfoot? Or do you think, what would you say?
So I'm not at liberty to discuss the findings from last season. No. But I'm going to say this. Definitely have some findings now that I think like we're closer than ever before, without saying too much, and and maybe on it, right? Like, I cannot say, but what I will say is that when I first started working on this, I would kind of ignore all of the, let's call it, the high strangeness that surrounds Bigfoot. And now I'm starting to see like patterns and different things. And honestly, talking to people who have had experiences, who have a lot to lose by sharing their story. Like, some of them had never even told their wives or anyone, and their police officers, their psychologists, like they have a lot to lose. And when you see them and hear them, like, they still have that, the chills, and they get afraid, that they're afraid to go back in the woods. So, is it possible? Well, sure. Like, honestly, I discovered a new species not that long ago, and we make new discoveries every day. So for me to say we know everything that's out there, that would be actually going against everything I believe in science. Like, you have to stay open-minded and be curious. And truthfully, I think that there is a lot out there that we don't know. So is it possible? I think so.
If there is a Bigfoot, right? What do you think is the biggest reason or factor that he hasn't yet been discovered? Do you think he's just in such a remote place, or what would you, I mean, just what would be your take from a non-scientific,
No, but that's a great question. I think, for example, I've dedicated my whole life to studying very rare, elusive primates that had never been photographed up until just a few years ago. And I think if you're dealing with, especially if it's a primate, like it's described, a highly intelligent animal that may even have some human characteristics, again, this is all based on description, then they would be smart enough to know that humans are like destroying environment. Humans are killing animals everywhere. I mean, who knows the why? But I kind of think if we're dealing with what people describe as a super intelligent being that's closely related to us or primates, then they're probably smart enough to know to stay away from humans. Basically, I think it's as simple as that.
You know, I get a lot of interesting people I speak with, and I'm going to say you're one of the most interesting in a sense where we could have actually did five separate podcasts, basically. No, because there's so much to talk about. I mean, again, when we're talking about, you know, how you transition from, you know, obviously being an attorney, transitioning over, being a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader.
Miami Dolphins, wrong team.
I'm sorry, Dallas Cowboys. You know what it is? There's only one team I hate more than the Dolphins, and it's the Cowboys. I'm sorry. Miami Dolphins cheerleader. That's a whole thing, especially since you were never a cheerleader, right? And then the whole thing with National Geographic and being their first wildlife correspondent is, that's awesome. And then getting, you know, approached by Mark Burnett, that's amazing. And then you know, this whole Bigfoot thing. I mean, we could have had literally, I wish I had more time with you because we could have actually had a half hour on each particular thing. And then we'd even get into, like I said, you discovered a species that was never even seen before, which again, I wanted to touch on that very quickly because I mean, that's super interesting. So if you'd be just so kind enough to really share with us how that happened, and then we'll start to wrap everything up.
Well, that's been like a highlight of my career because I never imagined I would.
Right, that's what I wanted to get to it.
Yeah, world's smallest primate, and it fits in the palm of your hand. It's like about that big. It weighs less than 2 ounces, and yeah, it had never been documented before, photographed, described. So I got to name it, and it really was like a dream come true in a sense for a scientist. And it's funny hearing you talk about my kind of unusual trajectory through all of these things, because the one thing that is a common thread through all of them, and I think to speak to your podcast, right, which is even why I was excited to do this, is that it's all about going for it and taking risks and not letting fear decide, right? Just, or what other people think decide. I mean, just that screw it, I'm going to go for it and I'm going to do it. And every single one of those cases, it was about me just going, yeah, I'm just going to do this. I don't really care what anyone else says or thinks.
And that's amazing because again, that's what truthfully what this whole podcast was created for, you know, where you could have went left or right and you took the chance and, you know, you got to where you are now. Before we let you go, can you just let everybody who's listening know, how they can find you on social media and how they can follow you, and, you know, reach out if, you know, they have any interview questions.
Yeah. You could reach me through my website, which is mireyamayor.com, MIREYAMAYOR, or through Instagram, which is also pretty easy. It's just at Mireya Mayor. But yeah, I'd love when people send me questions, and if they have stories to share, I'm all ears.
Again, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, as you know, we follow each other on Instagram. So obviously, you know, I'll be watching, and you know, as things progress, which I know with you, they probably will. I'd love to have you back on. Again, if you're listening one more time, just like Mireya, if you dream, dream out loud. Don't talk shit. Create shit. You know, that's, if you're not inspired after this one, I don't know what would inspire you. So again, once again, we'd like to thank our producers, Sage Spielman. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Believe, As always, we like to ask everybody out there to please leave a comment on the podcast. And we'll see you next week. And once again, if you dream, dream out loud. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Screw the Clout. Join us next week for our next amazing guest.